service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX audio service for February 2015. This is issue 361. I'm Scott Feibusch. The address for the DX audio service is National Radio Club's DX audio service, P.O. Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251. The email address is sales@nrcdxas.org. The musings number is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX audio service for U.S. and Canadian members is $30, and the magazine is published on CDs. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to Fred at the address just mentioned, or log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get the DXAS in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is $15. Just point a browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. Subscribe only if you are able to download and navigate a website without anyone's assistance. Fred will hopefully be back with a voice later in the magazine, but right now it's time to catch up on the changes with Dave Alpert and the AM Switch.
Hi, Dave Alpert with the February issue of AM Switch. I have two editions to cover, AM Switch Volume 82, Issues 7 and 8. We begin with call letter changes. 560 WXBT, Columbia, South Carolina, changes back to WVOC. That became effective December 15th. The buyers of WMSK 1550, Morganfield, Kentucky, have reserved WUCO for when the sale is complete. 810 WTHV, Hahira, Georgia, changes to WZYN. 1220 WJAX, Jacksonville, Florida, becomes WKTZ. 1230 KBCR, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, is now KBWZ. 1350 KCOR, San Antonio, Texas, changes to KXTN. 1400 KENT, Parowan, Utah, changes to KAZZ. 1410 KNAL, Victoria, Texas, is now Blowing Watts out as KITE. No other changes these last couple of weeks, so our remaining three-letter calls are all still safe. Dave Schmidt notes that the WIP calls are not gone, as they remain on WIP-FM 94.1, but the AM is now WTEL. As we reported last time, WTEL is, of course, an historic Philadelphia call sign as well, on 860 until 1998, and again briefly in 2000. New station watch, these CPs built and nearing final licensing. 1120 WUST, Washington, D.C., applies for license to cover CP for D4, 50,000 watts, critical hours power of 3,000, and moving to the WJFK 1580 towers. They have been granted program test authority. 1180 KCKQ, Sparks, Nevada, the CP for this new station reported to be U2, 4,000 watts day, 190 watts night. Applies for license to cover and granted program test authority. 1380 KVSM, Santa Maria, California. This new station is already on the air, granted modification to pattern. Hopefully this means it can get its permanent license to cover soon. And 1240 KEWE, Kahului, Hawaii, applies for license to cover their CP for a new station, U1, 5 kilowatts day and night, and the station has been heard on the air already. Amendment to pending application. The 1210 application in Pine River, Minnesota, for a new station with U2 6,000 watts day, 250 watts night, has been amended to U2 5,500 watts day and 250 watts night. CPs expired and deleted. The construction permit for 1400 in Pauka, Hawaii, for a new station, U1 2,500 watts day and night, has expired and been deleted. And 1560 WIVS, Village of Superior, Wisconsin, CP for a new station, U4 5,000 watts day, 4,000 watts night, has expired and been deleted. construction permits for existing stations. These CPs are on the air. 1150 WSNW, Seneca, South Carolina. The CP for U1, 5,000 watts day and 58 watts night. 1260 WGVM, Greenville, Mississippi. CP for U1, 1,000 watts day, 32 watts night. 1450 KQTE, Hellendale, California. The CP for U1, 1 kilowatt day and night is on. And so is the 1470 KVSL Sholo, Arizona CP for U1, 5,000 watts day, 87 watts night. That station formerly on 1450. CP's built and nearing final licensing. KFAY, Farmington, Arkansas, applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 6,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night. 1340 KIKO, Apache Junction, Arizona, applies for license to cover CP with U1, 1,000 watts day, 930 watts night, moving from Miami, Arizona, which is about 40 miles west. 1580 KGAL, Lebanon, Oregon, applies for a license to cover their CP for U2, 5,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night. 1590 WARV, Warwick, Rhode Island, applies for license to cover their CP for U4, 8,000 watts day and 5,000 watts night. CPs previously granted, challenge denied. 1000 WIOO, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The FCC denied a challenge to WIOO's longstanding unbuilt construction permit for U4, 5,000 watts day and 60 watts night on 1010 from WOLB, Baltimore, Maryland, which had applied for a license to cover an incompatible upgrade to U1, 1,000 watts day and 30 watts at night on that same frequency. So WIOO should be able to move forward with the CP now if it so chooses. And amendments to pending applications. 1090 KQNM, Milan, New Mexico, has an application for D1, 900 watts at Sandia, New Mexico, on 1080, and amends that application to D1, 1,000 watts. And 1590 WALG, Albany, Georgia, has an application for U1, 2,500 watts day and 45 watts at night, and amends it to U1, 2,500 watts day and 40 watts at night. Construction permits granted. 920 WDMC, Melbourne, Florida, granted a CP for U4, 8,000 watts day, 4,000 watts night from a new site. 980 KMBZ, Kansas City, Missouri, granted a CP for U2, 9,000 watts day, 5,000 watts night. 1020 WURN, Kendall, Florida, granted a CP to modify their pattern. 1030 KFAY, Farmington, Arkansas, granted a construction permit for U4, 6 kilowatts day, 1 kilowatt night. 1100 WISS, Berlin, Wisconsin, granted a CP for D4, 50,000 watts day and critical hours power, 20,000 watts. 1360 WKAT, North Miami, Florida, granted a CP for U1, 9,300 watts day and 400 watts night from a new site. 1500 KCLF, New Roads, Louisiana, is granted a CP for U1, 850 watts day, 18 watts at night. 1520 WXYB, Indian Rocks Beach, Florida, granted a CP for U1, 1,000 watts day, 13 watts night. 1580 WLPK, Connersville, Indiana, granted a CP for U1, 245 watts day and 5 at night. And 1660 KWOD, Kansas City, Kansas, granted a construction permit to Diplex with KCNW 1380, remaining U1, 10,000 watts day and 1,000 watts at night. Applications filed. 600 KVNA, Flagstaff, Arizona, applies for U1, 1,000 watts day, 70 at night, moving to the KAFF 930 tower. 850 WQRM, Duluth, Minnesota, applies for D1, 50,000 watts day, and critical hours power, 14,000 watts. 1200 WAMB, Nashville, Tennessee, applies for D1, 10,000 watts day, and critical hours power of 3,800 watts. 1210 KMIA, Auburn, Federal Way, Washington, applies for U4, 27,500 watts day, 1,400 watts at night, consolidating operations at their current day site and reducing nighttime power. 1490 WTQS Cameron, South Carolina, applies for D1, 5 kilowatts day, 730 watts critical hours power on 1,500. And 1580 WIOL Columbus, Georgia, applies for U1, 2,100 watts day, 45 watts night, moving to the site of WOKS 1340. Special Temporary Authority 900 KTIS Minneapolis, Minnesota, granted an STA with U1 reduced power for tower repairs. 930 WKBM Sandwich, Illinois, granted an STA with parameters potentially at variance due to detuning system problems at a neighboring tower, which has affected their pattern. 910 WFDF Farmington Hills, Michigan, is granted an STA for parameters at variance. Pattern problems have been observed, but the cause is still unknown. 960 WHYL Carlisle, Pennsylvania, applies for U1, 1,300 watts day, 27 watts night from the WCAT-FM tower. 990 WDYZ Orlando, Florida, granted an STA for parameters at variance as their night pattern has been observed out of tolerance with the cause still under investigation. 1080 KVNI Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, applies for U1, 10,000 watts day, 250 watts night due to parameters at variance. 1280 KFRN Long Beach, California, applies for U1, 1,000 watts day and night, reason unknown. 1400 WSPG Spartanburg, South Carolina, granted an STA for emergency wire antenna with U1, 900 watts day and night. 1440 KETX Livingston, Texas, is granted an STA with U1, 15 watts day and night until a new transmitter is installed. 1450 KJCV Jackson, Wyoming, granted an STA for a temporary long wire antenna while wireless phone equipment at the tower shared with KSGT 1340 is upgraded. 1490 WOLF Syracuse, New York, granted U1 172 watts day and 750 watts night until CP facilities are licensed. And 1560 WLZR Melbourne, Florida, granted an STA with D1, 1,000 watts. These stations are informing the FCC they are silent. 580 WYHM, Rockwood, Tennessee, silent since December 7th as they lost their studio location and studio transmitter link. 620 KHNU, Hilo, Hawaii, was silent November 21st as they lost their temporary antenna to high winds. 1020 WRIX, Homeland Park, South Carolina, silent November 28th during transmitter repairs. 1230 KOZA, Odessa, Texas, silent as of November 24th as they need to move their studio to a new building. 1450 WLAY, Muscle Shoals, Alabama, silent as of December 15th, no reason given to the FCC. 1590 WVNA, Tuscumbia, Alabama, silent since December 15th, no reason given. These formerly silent stations have informed the FCC they are back on the air. 590 WARM, Scranton, Pennsylvania. 580 WYHM, Rockwood, Tennessee. 670 WMTY, Farragut, Tennessee. 700 WCNF, Dothan, Alabama. 850 WKVL, Knoxville, Tennessee. 900 WCBX, Bassett, Virginia. 930 WEZZ, Monroeville, Alabama. 1340 KSGT, Jackson, Wyoming. 1480 KBXD, Dallas, Texas. 1190 WWIO, St. Mary's, Georgia. 1240 WNRA, Eufaula, Alabama. 1300 WOSW, Fulton, New York. 1400 WSPG, Spartanburg, South Carolina. 1490 WOLF, Syracuse, New York. 1550 WZRK, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. 1560 KIQS, Willows, California. 1560 WLZR, Melbourne, Florida. 1600 WPDC Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, and 1600 WRJE Dover, Delaware. All back on the air. By the way, Radio Insight says KIDD 630 Monterey, California was off the air as of December 31st, but we've seen nothing on the FCC site about that yet. 1450 WZGX Bessemer, Alabama was deleted, as we reported earlier, when the FCC's letter to the station saying it had been silent for more than a year came back, returned to sender. Well, now the station has filed a change of address with the FCC, so it's back in the database. In O'Canada, 540 CBGA1, Grand Anse, New Brunswick, has their license canceled and deleted as the station moved to FM. 750 CBFA3, Wimontachi, Quebec, and LPRT canceled and deleted as they moved to FM. 790 CFCW, Camrose, Alberta, has announced that it will be moving to 840 this summer. 1250 CJYE, Oakville, Ontario, granted a construction permit for U3 10,000 watts day and night. The station is a former U4. The new 1280 in Toronto is granted a CP for a new station, U1, 99 watts day and night, college station that plans to broadcast 18 hours a day in English, and the call letters will be CJRU, 1280 Toronto. 1320 CJMR, Oakville, Ontario, granted a CP for U3, 10 kilowatts day and night. They were U4, 20,000 watts day, 10,000 at night, according to a note in Industry Canada's database. The city of license is Oakville, but the CRTC says Mississauga. 1340 CKDR1, Ignis, Ontario. The license is canceled and deleted. They've moved to FM. 1450 CBKE for Chipayan, Alberta, and LPRT with a license canceled and deleted as they move to FM. Cash register ringing on M Street. Forfeiture orders issued to KIUP 930 Durango, Colorado, and two co-owned FMs. $25,000 for operating studio transmitter links from unlicensed locations. KBXD 1480 Dallas, Texas, $7,200 for emergency alert system violations. KOMJ 1490 Omaha, Nebraska, fined $7,000 for failure to maintain a studio. In addition, the FCC granted a petition for reconsideration and reduced the fine to KVOL 1330 Lafayette, Louisiana, for EAS violations, reducing the fine from $14,000 to $6,000. The licensee of WSOK 1230 Savannah, Georgia, WTKS 1290 in Savannah, and four FM stations fined a total of $9,000 for equal employment opportunity violations. The licensee of WLEE 990 Richmond, Virginia, WVNZ 1320 Richmond, WTOX 1480 Glen Allen, Virginia, and WREJ 1540 Richmond fined a total of $5,000 for EEO violations. Thanks to Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Bruce Wickard, Lonnie Wetzbargner, Ernest Wasilowski, Terry Kruger, John J. Rieger, Steve Kennedy, Fred Volby, Powell Way, Rick Dow, Bob Lewis, who is Director of Operations at KERN, Walt Breville, and Bill Dvorak. I'm Dave Alpert in the DX Audio Service West Coast Studio, and that's the AM Switch for February. Remember, if you have any observations, let us know. The people I just mentioned were happy to report on stations, and you should too. Send your information to Fred. Till next time, here's Mark Durenberger with a band scan. National Radio
Club. Thank you, David, and hi, everyone. This month, we review a government proposal that would have seriously impacted radio listening in the United States. It was the initiative to move this country's broadcast stations to a 9 kilohertz spacing. and it surfaced back in 1979 with a government-based proposal, presumably floated in order to pack an additional 12 channels into the broadcast band. Fortunately, it died a timely death after short but confusing deliberation. Our story is taken from the FCC's report and order of 1981. Oh yes, in the telling of this tale, we'll succumb to the temptation to add personal opinion. On January 10, 1979, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA, filed a petition for rulemaking with the FCC. It requested a reduction in channel spacing in the U.S. from 10 kHz to 9. NTIA contended that such a spacing plan would make available additional channels while avoiding a possible HET interference problem with Region 1 and 3 stations. It would also offer an opportunity for at least some daytime-only stations to go full-time. Interestingly, the NTIA was seeking a solution for an almost insignificant problem. The primary reason they advanced for considering 9 kHz was concern for heterodyne interference. In my view, it's hard to believe that the U.S. government was concerned with HETs when their demonstrative activity in the intervening years has been to enable regulations that continues to shrink effective AM coverage areas, to the point today where for most stations only local coverage is viable, much less hearing HETs. As a response to the NTIA initiative, after a short period inviting public comment to the FCC, the U.S. participated in a planning session of the Worldwide Frequency Allocation Group, the ITU. In preparation for this conference, the U.S. formed an investigative task force to study the NTIA proposal. Preliminary findings indicated an additional 200 to 1,400 stations could be added, and many daytime stations could go full-time. What wasn't noted was that many on the task force had a vested interest in the outcome. A move to 9 kHz would be great for those task force members who were involved in selling new radios and transmission equipment. The costs to broadcasters to convert was first estimated to not exceed $15 million industry-wide, assuming that some unspecified commission technical requirements were relaxed and that station personnel performed some of the work. Over the next 18 months, this estimate would be a bouncing ball, depending on whose report you read. $15 million spread across the AM industry may not seem like a lot of money, even though in 1980 dollars, but broadcasters were also struggling with whether to invest in AM stereo and all the costs that would arise from necessary transmission upgrades to do so. You'll perhaps recall there were competing incompatible AM stereo standards out there at the time, and the FCC confused that market by originally selecting a stereo standard that was later rejected. Anyway, in a report adopted in December 1979, the FCC tentatively agreed that 9 kHz spacing would permit more AM stations, enable some daytimers to operate on limited time, and help to resolve incompatibilities between U.S. and neighboring assignments. It was therefore recommended that the United States propose at the first session of the Region 2 Planning Conference that it favorably consider 9 kHz channel spacing in its AM band. In January 1980, based on the Commission's recommendation, the Department of State submitted that proposal to the conference as an official United States position. Now, we know that channel spacing is a critical issue among international regulators, and it requires consensus among international broadcasters. After extensive discussions, the conference was unable to reach the desired consensus. The FCC record of the time does not discuss any other reasons for this failure to reach consensus, but almost certainly there was a backstory here. So, absent an agreement, the conference asked the International Frequency Registration Board, the IFRB, to undertake a comparative study of 9 and 10 kHz channel separation with the assistance of a panel of experts provided by the United States, Canada, Mexico, Cuba, Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, and Peru. In December 1979, an advisory committee on AM broadcasting in Region 2 had been formed with the cooperation of the broadcast industry to assist the commission in dealing with the various issues raised in the conference. On August 8, 1980, the commission released an interim report and further notice of inquiry in the matter of 9 kHz channel spacing. It contained the report of this latest task force and announced the preliminary views of the commission as enumerated in the original notice of inquiry. The report expressly characterized the views contained therein as tentative. Then in September 1980, the commission, at the request of the broadcast industry, amended the charter of the AM Advisory Committee. Its name was changed to the Advisory Committee on Radio Broadcasting, and it was charged with continuing the work of the existing committee with the added task of considering the relationship of present and prospective FM allocations to AM broadcasting. Thus was the hint of the impending FM allocation rulemaking thrown into the mix. What may have been forgotten was that the FCC was busy generating Docket 8090, which would do to the FM band what a series of channel packing rulings had already inflicted on the U.S. AM band. Now, a second international conference was scheduled. It was resolved to undertake regional planning of the AM broadcast service. Regional meaning those countries impacted by long-range U.S. AM signals. At the outset of this latest session, it was recognized that, apart from those assignments governed by the North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement, the NARBA, the agreement between the U.S. and the United Mexican States, and perhaps including a few other bilateral or sub-regional agreements, that the development of AM broadcasting in Region 2 had really proceeded on an ad hoc basis. It was admitted that little thought had been given to international coordination or to sound engineering practices region-wide, witness the 5 kHz splits from the Southern Hemisphere. The position statement of this conference said that many cases of interference between stations of different countries had not only been created but had been aggravated as nations resorted to unilateral remedies, frequently involving power increases. This, no doubt, a shot at Mexico's superpower border blasters and the Cuban interference brouhaha. The planners stated the obvious. In the event 9 kHz was adopted in the U.S., most stations would have to shift frequency. Planners suggested that the stations on any particular channel would have to remain together and change together during a channel reordering so as to maintain existing co-channel and adjacent channel relationships. As to the channel shifting, two channel shift plans were considered. Under the first, no station would shift frequency by more than 4 kHz. The new channels would be evenly spaced throughout the AM band every 90 kHz. The second plan would oblige some stations to shift frequency by as much as 9 kHz. The new channels would be evenly distributed by pairs every 171 kHz. Sound complicated? It surely was. The two plans became known as the 9-4 and 9-9 plans, respectively, and of course added further variability and confusion to the deliberations. So an international working group of broadcast specialists was formed, yet another group, to begin drafting technical planning criteria and a regional agreement, considering as three alternatives the two 9 kHz plans and the existing 10 kHz arrangement. Attempting to bring simplicity to their deliberations, the group used the first computer analysis program to determine the theoretical effects on various stations. The study showed that the following full-time assignments could be made. The existing plan, 10 kHz, Class 1A channels, 58 assignments, no change. The 9-4 plan provided retention of the existing Class 1A protection, plus 12 new channels that would open up 124 new station assignments. The third plan, the 9-9 plan, provided retention of the existing Class 1A protection, plus new channels that would open up 170 new station assignments. But a follow-on computer study produced conflicting information on the impact of the changes, so the public was once again invited to comment. Meanwhile, you recall the first session of this conference had decided to establish a panel of experts from those eight Region 2 countries to assist in the studies. It turned out considerable difficulty was encountered in performing the group's studies because of problems with the computer programs. As a result of infirmities with the computer program, it was found necessary to limit the study to nighttime incompatibilities, limit the number of incompatibilities studied, and eliminate or restrict the scope of other studies, such as adjacent channel interference or interregional interference. This state of affairs must have diminished planners' confidence in getting it right, since they were ignoring many of the potential effects. As a further example, the study concerning the potential for new assignments was deleted, primarily, they said, because of lack of time. And in my view, this sounds like a typical rulemaking planning session, but hey, I wasn't there. One thing that did come out of this latest study was the agreement that neither the 9-4 or 9-9 plan was superior to the other in resolving incompatibilities. Thus was one variable removed. Now the cost estimate brouhaha resurfaced. Yet another study recognized at the outset that it would not be feasible to determine the cost of conversion of each of the 4,600 AM radio stations on an individual basis, so wide-ranging cost estimates were submitted. The first raised the original $15 million guess to close to $20 million. Then a noted consulting engineer weighed in, and his estimate was that broadcasters' conversion to 9 kHz would really be $28 million. Next, the ABC Network Engineering Group came in with their own calculations that, based on actual numbers derived from its owned stations, the actual station conversion costs across the country would approach $40 million. That was followed by a new estimate from the aforementioned noted consulting engineer. His number was now $44 million. In considering the costs to replace radio receivers, a similar group of wide-ranging estimates was reported, none of them defensible. It must have been impossible for negotiators to take solid positions based on such soft and variable numbers. The FCC, by this point, must have been bewildered. Well, after the cost guesstimates came the technical impact guesses. The FCC study group studied overall AM band system performance at 9 kHz as opposed to the existing 10 kHz standard. First noted was that adjacent channel interference would likely increase. Illogically, reports had it that this wouldn't be a problem at night, since a lot of the interfering stations had to sign off at sunset. We say illogical because one of the original reasons for the 9 kHz study was to allow daytimers to operate at night. Anyway, more numbers were thrown around. Things like only 5% interference were presented as formal study outcomes. Of course, another study said only 2.4% interference, whatever either of those numbers meant. Besides, these studies said most radio receivers had such narrow response that they wouldn't detect the difference between 10 and 9 spacing. A second part of the FCC technical study examined the problem of nighttime skywave to groundwave adjacent channel interference. It compared the predicted signal strengths produced by several types of 5 kilowatt and 50 kilowatt stations with the FCC's interference criteria as adjusted for 9 kilohertz. Here it was suggested that the limits on permissible interference would be exceeded only for Class 1 and Class 2A stations. Oh well, they said, the Class 1A stations had generally received exceptional protection anyway for many years and would not likely be affected by adjacent channel skywave interference. Just think, what if they'd known about IBOC? The study also noted that the service areas of the Class 2A stations are limited by their co-channel Class 1A stations to such an extent that adjacent channel skywave interference, in their words, would not be a problem. This left the 34 Class 1B stations to be evaluated. The study concluded that some of them would receive adjacent channel skywave interference if 9 kHz were adopted. They declined to put a number on it. So now these advisors were apparently willing to throw away protection for clear channel stations. Fortunately, the FCC wasn't buying these inconsistent and undefinable numbers. Then the studies turned to the benefit of eliminating HETs with a 9 kHz conversion. Here the commission decided at the outset that defensible information simply couldn't be gathered, given the variations in propagation, the sunspot cycle, and other phenomenon. About the only thing everyone seemed to agree on was that AM stereo would work at either frequency spacing, but from what we know today, that probably wouldn't have been true either. Finally, the studies turned to the economic benefits of spacing reduction. The FCC's report and order in the end had to agree that a lot less stations would benefit than was originally suggested. The FCC also admitted the scenario of adding 12 new channels and more than 150 new stations might be more than the Commission's public policy structure could manage. The FCC's report and order went on to discuss how a 9 kHz conversion would be implemented. Since the channel changes would have to be frequency by frequency, the FCC felt that unacceptable interference would be caused during the process, and also submitted that some stations would have to convert frequencies twice before they settled on their new channel. They also threw in a wild card reflective of the times. They said, would the increasing interference from Cuban stations not following the spirit of international agreements actually become even worse? Some experts thought, that would likely be the case. And finally, what about Canada? Here the proposal suggested a 9 kHz USA could coexist with a 10 kHz Canada, in their words, simply by negotiating adjustments to Canada's station assignments. What a strange, impractical world the 9 kHz proponents must have been occupying. The Commission concluded its report and order dismissing this proposal by stating that the costs and uncertainties of a 9 kHz conversion outweighed the vague benefits. In the FCC's language of November 5, 1981, quote, accordingly, it is ordered, pursuant to authority found in Sections 4I and J and Section 403 of the Communications Act of 1934, as amended, that this proceeding is terminated. Yours truly, FCC. It's inconceivable that a 9 kHz proposal would ever again surface in the United States. Meanwhile, DXers continue to reap the benefits of IDing foreign signals by the HETs they produce. Most, if not all, of the listeners who were predicted to receive heterodyne interference were gone to FM within a decade. Due to channel congestion, most of the big AM stations have had to focus on servicing smaller and smaller service areas, comparable to the coverage of their FM competition. And of course, today, many former AM listeners are migrating to online. The irony is that this proposal might have been acceptable at an earlier time, before the AM band was starting to become hideously congested, and in an era where AM analog receivers were good enough to handle the 9 kHz spacing, and there were no digital receivers to convert, at a cost to be borne, no doubt, by the decreasing listener base. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. The opinions expressed in the 9 kHz spacing matter are solely mine and not those of the National Radio Club. You might think 9 kHz would have been a good thing, but now we'll never know. We trust it's been useful to understand the process that led to the 1981 9 kHz dismissal, and we hope we didn't overcomplicate things. We'll be back in this corner in about 30 days with more of our BandScan information. Until then, good listening, DXers. National Radio Club.
John B. Wells fired for being too popular and truthful. An exclusive interview by David Hodges in The Common Sense Show. John B. Wells has been one of the most recognized voices in America, but unfortunately, a million Americans will no longer get to hear his melodious voice on Saturday nights on what was his popular coast-to-coast AM radio broadcast. The following is an exclusive print interview I conducted with John B. Wells on the evening of February 5, 2014. Why was this ever so popular host let go by some unidentified powers to be in the corporate structure of Coast to Coast? On the surface, the firing of John B. Wells made no sense. However, as we peel back that public veneer that is Coast to Coast, the firing of John B. Wells was inevitable. The glory days of Coast to Coast are gone. In days gone by, Coast to Coast was once the flagship of the alternative media, which captured 500 stations in late-night radio when the show was hosted by Art Bell. Bell blazed a trail that nobody had ever traveled before. As he brought in subjects to the mainstream airwaves, they were unprecedented in both the subject areas and the depth of coverage. Bell's meteoric rise to unprecedented popularity in late-night radio continued unabated until Premiere purchased control of the show for $8 million. That is when the trouble began for Bell in terms of restraining editorial control of his show. When Art Bell relinquished control of his program to corporate interests, Premiere, and ultimately Clear Channel Radio, Coast to Coast was never the same, as the show took a turn and became reflective of the corporate message. The corporate structure of Coast to Coast. One cannot fully appreciate the termination of John B. Wells as the Saturday Night Guy on Coast without having some understanding of the corporate structure which came to dominate the show when Art Bell relinquished control of the show. Premiere Radio distributes Coast to Coast for its parent company, Clear Channel Communications, now iHeartMedia. Clear Channel has a long and well-known history of censorship and extreme retaliation for those who do not abide by the corporate line. Clear Channel was once a major supporter of the George W. Bush candidacy for president, and they tolerated no dissension within the ranks. They were responsible for the dramatic fall of the Dixie Chicks for exposing their anti-war views with regard to the war in Iraq, and in a case of extreme censorship, with regard to a case that I have had some first-hand and personal knowledge of, a popular Phoenix talk show host, Charles Goyette, was blackballed by Clear Channel for similar anti-war views. Charles was actually dismissed from KFYI Radio when he was the number one radio personality in Arizona and the entire Southwest. When it came to these corporate entities, having great ratings does not insulate one from being fired. Popular talk show hosts are expected to be the guardian of the corporate gate, as you'll soon read. Wells is an oracle who quotes Voltaire and tells the truth, but he was a poor night watchman of the corporate-controlled gate. Wells discovered that deviating from the company line, i.e., telling the truth, shortens the profession's life expectancy of its top entertainers. The numbers do not lie. For a period of prolonged instability following the departure of Art Bell as the primary host of Coast to Coast, George Norrie entered the scene in 2003, where he has since remained. However, Norrie's listening numbers are nothing to write home about. Once upon a time, some estimated that Art Bell had somewhere around 6 to 12 million listeners on any given night. In contrast, Norrie's numbers are a paltry 275,000 to 300,000 listeners per night. However, George Norrie is the perfect frontman, and his numbers take on a secondary level of importance because he is very good at protecting the corporate turf and is very careful to only take risks on subjects which the corporate sponsors do not care about, i.e. crystal skulls, near-death experiences, psychic mediums, etc. Gone are the former days of Art Bell's hard-hitting journalism, which made the spooks inside the alphabet soup agencies very uncomfortable. Coast to Coast has become a vanilla broadcast, with occasional forays into controversy with guests such as Jim Mars. However, much of Coast to Coast today is what I call disguised controversy, which presents the illusion of objective journalism. John B. Wells temporarily bridged the gap of Art Bell's former independent style that made him so popular in the present-day version of Coast to Coast. John B. Wells was clearly the shining jewel of the Coast to Coast empire, a disturbance within the force. John B. Wells is a self-confessed independent maverick with a streak of independence, which makes him so very likely to convey the truth on his own broadcasts. Wells had actually been hosting shows on Coast to Coast since 2005 as a fill-in until he was hired as the permanent host for Saturday nights in 2011. John B. Wells' numbers were anywhere between 750,000 to 1.2 million listeners for any given Saturday night. This rating disparity could not have resonated well with George Norrie, who is not known for being humble. There were some who were in favor of making Wells the permanent host of the show during the week. This idea was met with draconian repression in an effort to preserve the status quo. George Norrie is a great protector of the corporate interest, and that is first and foremost in importance to management. This speaks to the clear message of what Coast to Coast has become. Norrie's show is the quintessential guardian of the corporate gate instead of being what it purports to be, a news dissemination source. His role as the Saturday night host on Coast to Coast AM, John B. Wells became a man trapped between his desire to expose the truth and the requirement that he walk the corporate line. John lamented, both publicly and privately, that Coast to Coast AM was not his show. He was just an employee. Wells expressed the desire to do something more meaningful because there was just not enough substance on Coast to Coast. This is a statement I wholeheartedly agree with, as I found the show, under Norrie's tenure, to have slipped to the level of a typical corporate-controlled media outlet. The beginning of the end. I first heard that John was going to begin his own independent talk show back in late fall or early winter of 2013. The new show was going to be called Caravan to Midnight. I was told that he was going to try to simultaneously do both shows. I was also told that his new show would be a no-holds-barred show. It was at that time that I told my news director, Annie Del Riccio, that Coast to Coast would never permit both shows to exist simultaneously. Can you imagine what the listening public would say if Wells were to interview former CIA operative James Garrow on his new Caravan to Midnight show, and that interview was much more revealing than anything ever heard on Coast to Coast from the same guest? It would have been obvious for even most of the blind to see that Coast to Coast practices censorship. Therefore, Wells would not be allowed to broadcast on both venues. My predictive words were proven true. On January 25, 2014, Wells formally announced the launch of his new show, Caravan to Midnight, which would debut on February 3, 2014. Subsequently, John was unceremoniously fired by Julie Talbot on January 28, 2014. By that evening, I noticed that every reference to John B. Wells was scrubbed from the Coast to Coast website. Please allow me to speak clearly to one key point. The firing of John B. Wells was prima facie evidenced in the corporate structure, that is, Clear Channel, iHeartMedia, of Coast to Coast, and it still practices the same extreme censorship as we saw with the Dixie Chicks and Charles Goyette in the case of the same song, different verse. Censorship was already being practiced on Wells' show all too often. His show would experience technical failures and be taken down in large local markets by such things as Amber Alerts or just plain old dead air. In contrast, Norrie's show rarely experiences the same issues. Wells said that the technical failures happened most often when he was interviewing a controversial guest in his first hour. Coincidentally, this past Sunday, my network re-ran an October 6, 2013 interview I did with John, and the interview went silent. The commercial still played, but the dialogue between myself and John went black. The decision to let John go must have been an agonizing one, as Wells' ratings were all so good. However, there could still be no question that Norrie was instrumental in the decision to fire Wells. There can also be no doubt that George Norrie's ego was certainly a factor in the dismissal of Wells. Norrie's penchant for complete control and intolerance toward dissenting opinion is well known to many, and it was only a matter of time until either Norrie or Wells had to go, and the corporate golden hair boy won out over the truth teller. Interestingly, Wells never looked at this situation as competition. As he said, I simply focused on doing my job. Adding fuel to the fire, I had heard reports which stated that Nori attempted to garner key guests before Wells could interview them in an obvious attempt to close the rating gap between he and Wells. A most insincere farewell. After I heard the news that John B. Wells was fired from Coast to Coast, I tuned into the show to hear what Nori would say about that event. The announcement by Nori that Wells was no longer a part of the show and the network was going in a different direction, and it lacked absolutely any sincerity. Based on my observation of Nori's demeanor on that night following the Wells dismissal, it was my personal opinion that Nori was pleased to have the major threat to his status as the king of late-night radio banished from the scene. In addition, the corporate-controlled message was preserved, and everyone won when Wells was fired, except the listening audience. Personally, I'm saddened by John's departure. However, I am relieved because I can now catch up on my sleep because there is not much worth listening to on Coast to Coast AM, in my humble opinion. A victory for the truth movement. Never before has the alternative media seen such a seismic shift. The departure of John B. Wells from Coast to Coast AM represents a major shift in the demographics which will soon be flooding the truth movement. It is often said that the rise of tide lifts all boats, and this is the effect that Wells' departure from Coast will have on our industry. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, will defect to John's new endeavor, Caravan to Midnight, airing Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. What Command Central at Coast failed to anticipate is people largely tuned in on Saturday night to listen to John. Most do not listen to the show because the name Coast to Coast. The people follow a specific person. As John's listening audience follows him to his new endeavor, many will soon discover other quality alternative programming, heretofore unknown to them. Move over, people. We're about to get some more company over the next several months. History will show that the corporate structure of Coast would be wise to have followed a policy of Wells in controlling the opposition by presenting the illusion of media choice. A new beginning. John told me that many of his passions include stopping immigration so that more Americans could find work, to get elected officials to follow the Constitution. John's new show, Caravan to Midnight, is totally listener-supported. Subscriptions can be purchased from the website for $60 for 12 months. The historic significance of this event cannot be overstated. John B. Wells will largely be responsible for the truth of waking up millions of Americans. On that note, I'm glad to welcome John to the alternative media, both as a friend and a colleague. I also pray for John's well-being because the power shift that is about to occur will certainly draw the unhappy attention of the self-proclaimed power elite in this country. This story has been John B. Wells fired for being too popular and truthful. An exclusive interview by David Hodges in the Common Sense Show. And the music you're listening to is John B. Wells with a song called Get Out of Here.
This is Scott Feibusch in Rochester, New York, with a few words about the upcoming 2015 DX Convention. You've been waiting for an official announcement that there will be a convention this year? There's going to be a convention this year. It will take place July 10th, 11th, and 12th of 2015, and it will happen this year in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It will be sponsored by not just the National Radio Club, but also the IRCA, the WTFDA, and Decalcomania. We're all getting together just like we did in Minneapolis in 2013 for a joint convention. We don't have official registration information for you just yet. We're still working on negotiating a final deal with our hotel, but here's what we can tell you so far. If you're in Fort Wayne, Indiana by midday on Friday, July 10th, you can take part in some introductory activities that first night, including a great minor league ball game at beautiful Parkview Field in downtown Fort Wayne, Indiana, where we will see the Fort Wayne Tin Caps. There's a festival going on all weekend in town, too, the Three Rivers Festival. So bring the family. If you've got a wife or kids, bring them along. Enjoy some good times in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Fort Wayne is really easy to get to. It's within a day's drive of nearly half the U.S. population. If you're anywhere from New England in the east, Minnesota in the north, all the way out west to Iowa and Nebraska, south all the way to Tennessee, you are within a day's drive of Fort Wayne, Indiana. There's air service from most major carriers. You can get there on Greyhound, and the Amtrak train stops just a little bit to the north in Waterloo, Indiana. We'll have announcements about transportation help for you as well coming up. Stay tuned to the DX Audio Service and to the pages of DX News and to the NRC and IRCA websites. We'll have a lot more information coming for you about this great joint convention of America's DX clubs. But for right now, save that date. It's July 10th, 11th, and 12th, and it's all happening in beautiful Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hope we'll see you there.
For the second time in about a week, WAKV AM in Otsego, Michigan, had its computers hacked and locked by ransomware. The following is an excerpt from Radio Inc. magazine, an interview with General Manager of WAKV, Jim Higgs. He tells us what happened.
Thanks for joining us today on Radio Inc. We're talking to WAKV owner and General Manager Jim Higgs. How you doing, Jim?
Doing pretty good, John.
All things considered?
We're getting there.
It's been an exciting few days for you. You've gotten a lot of press. You even mentioned today that the Canadian broadcasters were sending somebody down to interview you, correct?
Well, I think it's going to be a phone interview, but I had a call from Toronto a little while ago, and the CBC wants to do an interview.
Right. If you haven't been following this story, Jim's radio station, is it Otsego, Michigan?
It's Otsego.
Otsego, okay.
And Plainwell.
I see. So you serve both of those markets. Anyways.
Right. The station is actually licensed to Otsego.
Right.
The studio is in my home in Plainwell.
That makes it easy to get up and go to work in the morning.
The drive to work is really kind of easy.
Especially with those Michigan winters.
Well, that's correct.
Yeah. Jim's station, WAKV, was the victim of ransomware, where all the computer files got locked up, and basically you had to redo everything from scratch to get back on the air.
Pretty close. We were able to none of the audio files, we weren't able to salvage any of those, but some of the other files on the computer we were able to salvage. But the entire 4,000-plus record library was gone.
Wow.
And all of the commercials, all of the jingles, all of the announcer voice tracks, all of the production aids and archive material going back to 1995.
That's pretty much any broadcaster's nightmare, especially for a broadcaster, you know, running a small market station in Michigan. I mean, what was the first thing that ran through your mind when you saw the message on screen on the computer that they wanted $500 or you wouldn't get your files?
Well, the first thing that ran through my mind was, I'm not paying anybody $500. That's just not going to happen.
Said like a true Michigander.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like any extortionist. You know, I don't play that game.
It was the principle of the thing, huh?
Well, there's the principle of it, and the more I think about it, you know, if you pay people like that, that just encourages more of that kind of behavior.
Of course.
And I just don't see the point in doing it. Now, if we had been unable to save anything at all, I might have thought a little bit more about it, but I still don't think I would have done it, even if I had to, you know, start everything from scratch. We were lucky in that the music library, or 90% of the music library, was backed up on an old computer that was not connected at the time that the attack took place. So we were able to transfer all of that back into the on-air computer, and within probably 18 hours, we had a music library again.
Right.
We still didn't have our announcers, our jingles, and, you know, all of that other stuff. But at least we could run a reasonable facsimile of regular programming.
Right.
And
So you had to call everybody back in to re-record all their promos and drops and everything?
Yeah, we have three other people besides myself. I do the live morning show.
Uh-huh.
And then we have three other people that voice stuff for us. One of them was back in yesterday and redid all of his things. The other one was in Florida until last midnight. So now he's back from Florida with laryngitis. So he's going to be on vacation a little longer.
How was the outpouring from the community from your local station? Were people aware of what happened? And if they were, what happened? What did they do?
You know, I think being as it happened on a Friday, late Friday afternoon, and we used to be a daytimer. We've got what they call flea power at night now. So, I mean, 100 watts covers the community, but I'm not so sure anybody was really aware of what was going on. We were off the air all night Friday night.
Right.
By 8 o'clock Saturday morning, I had managed to restore about an hour's worth of instrumental music. And I recorded a couple of announcements to go in the middle of it, and we just let that play over and over and over again until I could restore the rest of the music library. And by Sunday morning, we were back sounding fairly normal, but without any of our announcers.
Right. Well, we're talking to WAKV owner and general manager who had his station hacked by ransomware, and he's back on the air. That's the good news. What advice would you have for managers? As you know, Radio Inc. is a magazine for managers in the broadcasting business. What advice would you give them to avoid something like you've seen?
I don't know that there's a way to avoid it. Perhaps some of the better virus software would stop it, but I don't really know whether it would. The big advice I have for everybody is make sure your backups are up to date.
Right.
Back up everything. See, and I was lax on that. I'm a great procrastinator.
Yeah, and especially back it up off-site, because with these ransomware, if the drive that you're even backing up to is a writable drive, it will also encrypt that drive
as
well.
That's right.
So something off-site like I believe you use Carbonite.
I use Carbonite, yeah. John, and the thing is that we put a new computer in here early last summer, and we have two hard drives in the new one. We have an electronic drive that handles programs, and then we have a standard hard drive that carries all of the data. And the electronic drive is the C drive in this new computer, and the old computer was set up with Carbonite to back up the C drive. Well, it just didn't even occur to me that we had to add another drive to the backup.
Yeah.
And there you go.
And, you know, I'm not giving anybody a plug here, but one of the... I also come from an IT background as well as a broadcasting
mm-hmm.
background. There's a service that is called CrashPlan. I don't know if you've heard of that. One of the nice things about them is it's off-site like Carbonite, but if you have an emergency situation, they will overnight you a hard drive. So you don't have to you don't have to re-download everything via the internet.
Wow, that would be a pretty good deal.
Yeah. And
that old computer really came in pretty doggone handy, because that's where the music was. A lot of the data files for the music selector program were on there.
Right.
And there was a backup for the traffic and billing program on there, although it was 6 months old. So I really didn't have to rebuild as much as I might have if that old computer hadn't been sitting on a desk behind me and thankfully not turned on when we got hit.
Right. Yeah, you kind of got lucky there. You know.
I did.
You dodged part of the bullet anyways. Jim, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. I know you're really, really busy getting your station back together, and the press have been hounding you because it's an interesting story.
Yeah, we've talked to two newspapers and had three TV stations in here, and now the CBC is coming with an interview this afternoon.
So, you know, look at it this way. It was a disaster, but look at all the press you've gotten.
I know. It's probably thousands of dollars worth, so who can complain, right?
Yeah. Jim, I really appreciate you talking to us, and I envy you in a lot of ways, not because of your hacking, but, you know, working out of your house in a small market radio station in Michigan, it just sounds like a whole heck of a lot of fun.
Well, I've been doing this business for almost 53 years now.
Right.
And the last 20 have been this home operation. And it really, it's the best of both worlds. You know, you've got your station in your house. You can deal with crises immediately. You don't have to drive anywhere. On the other hand, you also can't get away from it.
Yeah.
and that can be a problem at times, too.
Yeah,
but all things considered, it hasn't been too bad.
Jim Higgs, thank you so much from WAKV-AM in Otsego. Is it Otsego or Otsego?
Otsego.
Otsego. I should know that. I lived in Detroit for a while. I should know that, but I don't. Otsego, Michigan. Thank you so much for talking to us today on Radio.
Nice talking with you, John.
I should mention that after the interview was conducted, about an hour later, the station was hacked for a third time, losing all their content again. Just a lesson to be learned in protecting your computer.
Well, it's a natural fact, man, you're on the right track. Stay right here till we get back. We'll be back, hey, Jack. The news.
Please flip the tape to side 2.